wonder, but they call me Blondie. I'm better known as the one and only. I'm 5'2", built so fine, 36, 26, 36, down. I'm better known as Pecan Chan, a sequence freak with all the fans. So when I clap my hands and I stomp my feet, I jam to the sound of the sequence beat. I wave your hands in the air, I wave them like you just don't care. Like a Ginger Rogers and a Fred Astaire, my main man, a Yogi Bear. I set a hip my jazz and a rasp my jazz, and I jam to the disco beat. And if you can move your body like you move your hands, then I'm sure you can move your feet. Cause I'm supersonic, I'm a 3X tonic. When I'm not down, I'm up. And when I get real hungry, I run to the store and get me my Reese's Cup. I watch TV on my own. You got a yabba dabba doo, a Fred, a Flintstone. I'm sweeter than candy, I'm sweeter than honey. That's why they call me Blondie. I'm super cool and I'm super fine, and I'm one of a kind to shock your mind. And you can ring my bell all through the night, or you can rock my body to the early light. But don't ring my bell saying please if you cannot fulfill my needs. I don't mean to brag, I don't mean to boast, but they call my name from coast to coast, from the coast of California to the shore of Maine. Everybody loves the way I play my game. Say I got more rhymes in the back of my mind than Billy D. I love us. I say I got style and I got class. I don't talk my stuff too fast. Say I'm cold as ice, I'm twice as nice. I get more sick than a cat chase mice. Blondie, hey, that's me. I'm rapping in the key of R-A-P. I said bye bye baby boogie, a boogie baby boogie baby boogie boogie goodbye. Said a bye bye baby boogie, a boogie baby boogie baby boogie boogie goodbye. And you heard the raps of Blondie, and it was all the way loud. I said Blondie, hey, that's me. I'm rapping in the key of R-A-B.
Said a ring ding dong, ring a ding 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 dong, ring ding dong, ring a ding 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 dong.
They call me Cheryl, and I tell you why, cause I got such sexy bedroom eyes. When I pop them out and you look surprised, I got you and you're hypnotized. My love is strong if you can stand to be within my sexy trance. But don't let this tell you all about me. I'm a jealous lady and that you see. If I don't get the things that I mention, that's when I start crying for attention.
Attention!
That's what I say, and things is always go my way. Well, I talk a lot, but I'm really shy. My loving ways just get me by. I ride the baddest sounds around. I'm guaranteed to throw down. The only difference between you and me, and that is that I'm sexy. I'm an angel possessed with some devilish eyes, with a curvy hips to make your nature rise.
Ring ding dong, ring a ding 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 dong, ring ding dong, ring a ding 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 dong.
I said Angie B is a what they say. I got chocolate hips and the Milky Way, and I feel like a millionaire in space, flying on a go-kart with a silver lake. Everybody calls me never wrong, cause I'm a freestyle freak with the funky song. Do you hear me talking? Do you hear me singing on the microphone? I want you sing along.
You go do it, you go do it, you go do it, do it, do it.
I got two great partners standing by me that's guaranteed to jam to the beat. One is Blondie, and she's right on time. She calls herself Miss Superfine. I said, sure, the pearl is the one with the eye. She's guaranteed to hypnotize. Said Angie B, hey, that's me. I can rock you so dangerously.
You go do it, you go do it, you go do it, do it, do it.
At 5:45, she got in a fix, and you called on Angie B. And you look surprised as I arrived. You see me dressed to a T.
You go do it, you go do it, you go do it, do it, do it.
Vancouver-based Young Liars is releasing their debut album, Tidal Wave, on June 24th via Network Records. They're hosting the release party along with Beatroot and CITR at the Fox Cabaret with local friends Gang Signs on June 14th.
was just waiting outside for her to find me. Picked up the pebbles from the front garden bed.
Check out Young Liars' latest music video for their single Night Window on Facebook or YouTube.
Today is Friday the 6th of May. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Sahar. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, CITR.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:03 and time for independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent, Marco, who will be presenting us with one of his programs this week.
We also have in segment two, Christine Kim's bio of East Vancouver activist and poet Bud Osborne, who passed away 1 month ago today.
Later in the program, we have a report from Morme discussing the impacts individual and small group achievements have on the community as a whole.
And in segment four, a resonating reconciliation documentary produced by CJ Rice and Ian Caplet of CKGI, courtesy of the NCRA Program Exchange.
First up, let's hear from Marco on the science and technology.
Good afternoon. This is Marco with UBC CITR's Science and Technology News for Friday, June 6. Now a story to the Vancouver Sun about the glaciers on Vancouver Island. The Vancouver Island glaciers, including the famous Comox Glacier, will be gone within 25 years, so says UVic geology professor Dan Smith. Smith was quoted as saying, "There are not many glaciers left." In the 1970s, there was an inventory done on the Vancouver Island glaciers, and at that time, Vancouver Island had 170 glaciers. Now, Professor Smith says, there are only 5 glaciers left, and the giant Comox Glacier is now only 1 kilometer squared. So compared with the glaciers in the Rocky, the Comox Glacier is a very tiny little thing. The glacial melting has occurred because the Vancouver Island glaciers were small to begin with, but also it has been because of global warming. So this is just another sign of our planet warming up. In another story in the Vancouver Sun, there was news that the Russian dandelion could yield environmentally friendly rubber. There is now test growth done on the Russian dandelion in Abbotsford. A farmer, Anvar Burunov, with Russian descent, has been talking about BC's future as a global rubber producer. Burunov is the president of Noba Bio Rubber Green Technologies, and he's now in a global race with dandelion growers in Ontario, Ohio, and Germany to come up with a highly yielding dandelion and an extraction process that can compete with conventional rubber. All rubber to this point has been from Asian rubber trees, but they are now growing slowly and suffering declining production. And of course, this is all due to global warming and climate change. The world's need for rubber is increasing, especially in tires and medical equipment. In pre-World War II times, farmers tried the Russian dandelion to produce rubber, but it was too expensive. Bridgestone now is trying to pioneer a new solvent-based extraction process for rubber, but Burunov is trying to, with the Russian dandelion, produce rubber that is solvent-free. In U.S. news, every 4 minutes, another American home or business is going solar. So solar power is on the increase in the United States. President Obama mentioned this statistic in his 2014 State of the Union address, and he gave reasons that people should now switch to solar power. Kaya Chatterjee from the World Wildlife Fund feels that individual feelings of responsibility to to the planet is not why people will choose solar power over other forms of power, but here are some reasons that Ms. Chatterjee thinks solar power is on the rise. First, solar power is on sale. The price of solar panels has dropped 80% since 2008. Solar is easy to install. It's like installing a digital satellite disk. And solar homes sell for more. A 2011 U.S. study from the U.S. Department of Energy quoted that solar homes are selling for $17,000 higher than average homes without solar power. Solar homes sell faster, and solar power is now popular. So maybe this trend can catch on with Canada itself. In other news, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency is launching a program to develop technologies to treat psychiatric disorders by electrically stimulating the brain. DARPA Subnets program, this is short for Systems-Based Neurotechnology for Emergent Therapies, will fund teams of researchers to develop brain interfaces, computational models of post-traumatic stress disorder and brain activity, and this is part of the Obama administration's Brain Initiative, a collaborative effort between government and industry to revolutionize understanding of the brain. So the U.S. is now looking for brain implants to treat psychiatric disorders. In other news, are you a dog or a cat person? News has come out now after a survey was done for dog and cat people, and the question was asked, do they really have different personalities? According to the study, dog people tended to be more lively and energetic and outgoing, but cat lovers, on the other hand, were more introverted, more open-minded, and get this, they were more intelligent too. So there's the further debate. Are you a cat or a dog lover? The debate goes on. Now we're going to look at the full moon. The full moon is luring ferocious fish, not werewolves and vampires, out of the deep darks of the ocean depth. One of these fish is called a muskie, and it's one of the most largest and most ferocious fish, but it only comes out during a full or new moon, new research has found. This new study provides scientific backing to decades of fishing lore, which claimed that this fish did come out during the full moon. In other news, a caveman campsite has been unearthed in London. On the side of the Thames River in London's Battersea neighborhood, there is a crystalline cube being built that will house the new U.S. embassy. But before this site is ready for diplomacy, it must be excavated because construction workers have found a caveman campground there. The caveman campground is dated 12,000 years back, and it has all kinds of Stone Age tools, charred remains of campsite, animal bones, human bones, and a possible fish trap. This was the same thing that happened during the construction of Rome's subway, where so many artifacts were uncovered, which delayed the subway construction for years. Scientists are now looking at a new era in our Earth. What is this new era? They're calling it a sixth mass extinction. Scientists now say that species on Earth are going extinct 1,000 times faster than they would have been without human influence. But scientists say there's still time to save the world from this biodiversity disaster. Between 100 and 1,000 species per million go extinct every year now, but before humans came on the scene, the typical extinction rate was about one extinction per 10 million years. So the study researcher, Stuart Prim, a Duke University biologist, presents this in livescience.com. Samsung has also designed another piece of equipment that we may have in our home soon. Is it a TV? No. Is it a DVD player or Blu-ray? No. It's a human fitness tracker. Whenever we want to have our cars fixed now, we drive it to the garage, they plug the car into a machine, and the machine tells us what's wrong with the car. Samsung is now developing a fitness tracker that is aiming to do the same thing. What could we find out from this? Samsung really hasn't said yet. They haven't explained how it would be attached to the body, but Samsung says it wants to bring the world closer to such an era of wearable technology used for personalized medicine. You have been listening to Science and Technology News on CITR. This is Marco.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Out for the tide at mine, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have segment two, Christine Kim's bio of East Vancouver activist and poet Bud Osborne, who passed away 1 month ago today.
Vancouver poet and community leader has passed away at the age of 66 last month in early May due to pneumonia. His incredible story has inspired the lives of many in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and most likely will continue to have a profound impact on the community. Born in Battle Creek, Michigan, Osborne faced a traumatic childhood. Walton Homer Osborne, Bud's father, was a traumatized alcoholic and committed suicide in jail when Bud was three. While Bud's real name was exactly that of his father's, Bud explains, quote, "Amid our peregrinations through poverty neighborhoods, I was so afraid of my name that when a tough alley urchin gang leader in another new location asked my name, I said my name was Raymond or something. But this raggedy kid replied, 'No, it isn't. It's Bud.' And I've insisted on being called Bud ever since." End quote. Bud himself attempted suicide at the age of 15 by swallowing several aspirin pills. In a heart-wrenching poem entitled 4 Years Old, Bud recalls seeing his mother raped by a stranger whom she had brought home from a bar. However, despite this traumatic childhood, Bud found solace in the books and poems he read in school and began to write poems in high school. Bud once said, quote, "I found out that there were poets whose lives were as messed up as mine. Reading poems helped me get through another hour, another night, another day." End quote. He attended Ohio Northern University for a short time, and according to his sister, it was after college that he got into drugs. Married with a son, Bud moved around perpetually, from Toronto to Toledo to New York, and eventually, after separating from his family, ended up in the downtown east side of Vancouver. After a near-fatal drug overdose, Bud was taken to St. Paul's Hospital, and emerging alive, decided to turn his life around. He entered detox and later credited his victory over heroin and alcohol to the support of a Roman Catholic priest who would not give up on him. Since then, Osborne has featured in several documentaries like Keys to Kingdoms and Down Here that reflects the stark reality of living on the mean streets of downtown Eastside Vancouver. Once 7 years clean, Osborne became a board member of the Vancouver-Richmond Health Board, the Carnegie Center Association, and VANDU, Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. From these positions, understanding that HIV and hepatitis C infections were raging in the neighborhood due to the sharing of needles in 1977, Bud advocated for the introduction of free injection sites. He even sometimes presented his motions in poem form. Bud's poems reflected the lived experience of poverty, addiction, and struggle, and stopped nothing short of being a completely raw portrayal of his experience and emotion. East Vancouver MP Libby Davis was a close friend who knew Osborne for over 20 years. She described him as a true hero to those living in the downtown East Side and said he inspired many throughout Canada with his words. I remember the time that people would fall silent as they listened intently to each and every word he spoke as like a prayer, said Libby Davis. And it was as though he spoke to each of us personally and deeply. Such is the impact this man had. His publisher, Brian Kaufman of Anvil Press, recalls, quote, in 1994, Bud delivered his typewritten manuscript, Lonesome Monsters, to the Anvil offices on the second floor of the Lee Building at Main and Broadway. And what I saw in Bud's work then was the same thing I see now, when I open one of his books, raw, brave, human, unadorned depictions of people caught in the meat grinder life of poverty, homelessness, addiction, and violence. He gave voice to the many that could not put it down in words, to the many who never listened to. The epigraph he gave me for the book was this: the primary intention of my writing has been fidelity to my experience and those of the people about whom I write. End quote. To listen to one of Bud's poems, please stay tuned. But apart from Bud's poems, Bud's won incredible recognition from the opening of InSite, Canada's first legal supervised injection site. His hard work in lobbying and advocating for this site has not only reduced the number of overdose deaths among local addicts, but has also raised a greater awareness of the reality so easily ignored in the downtown east side of Vancouver. The following poem is by Bud Osborne himself and is entitled Sunshine.
Sunshine on downtown east side sidewalks glows fresh crimson like rose petals fallen from ransacked gardens of the brokenhearted, from those who wear the violent evenings on faces bruised black and purple, whose teeth are kicked through panicked mouths begging mercy, whose sight is slashed blind by knives of darkness inside murdered souls, whose lives are worn out demolitions and screaming alleys of vomit and unending misfortunes. And for those crawling drunk and sick into jaws of rabid doorways and handcuffs of the police. And for those who fall or get pushed or raving, leap from caged-in hotel windows of desperation and hate and grief. And for those lining up more patient than saints in cold rain and seagull shit to receive crusts of bread. And for those sniffing glue beside railroad tracks of uselessness to derail a birthplace renovated into exile. And for those whose scared runaway skin is sold without hope to hypocrisy's ghosts. And for those cheated by political schemes and are drowned in tidal waves of unknown committees. And for refugees pouring in from the earth's economic wars. And for refugees fleeing wars in the roots of their hair. And for those straight-jacketed into numbers and things whose withered spirits don't interest the scientific God who has forsaken them. And for those run over by monstrous rush hours of skyscrapers and mountains of enormous wealth and who get busted for jaywalking, a puddle of small debt. And for those whose lungs are wrecked in a quicksand of malnourished, infested, tuberculous rent. And for those eaten by fear.
Sorry. Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have segment 3. We have a report from Morme Zenk discussing the impacts individuals and small group achievements have on the community as a whole.
But first, we're just going to do a quick PSA break. Thank you.
Peanut butter and jam!
What the f*** are you doing, Phil?
Right now, it's time to...
Peanut butter.
Damn!
First you dig peanuts and you dig them. You dig them. Then you crush them. You crush them. Then you spread them. You spread them. Peanut butter.
Damn!
Peanut butter.
Damn!
If you're looking for the best in local music and local food, it's got to be Peanut Butter and Jams with your host Brenda and Jordy, alternating Thursdays 6 to 7:30. Check it out.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
So now we have a report from Morme Zenki.
And tonight I'm going to talk about the youngest girl to ever climb Everest at the age 13. Malavath Porona becomes the youngest girl to climb Everest. She completed the ascent on May 25th, and she climbed impressively the most dangerous Tibetan side because the easier Nepal side does not allow climbers under the age of 16. It was a 52-day-long expedition and a 29,000-foot hike. Days after her arrival at base camp, an avalanche killed 16 Sherpas, but she was undeterred and still climbed Everest. She's from India. Her parents are Dalits, once known as untouchables. They only earned $600 a year. Her and Sendha Nepali and Nad Kumar were picked, hand-picked from a government social welfare program. Out of 150 students, 20 were shortlisted and then went to a mountaineering institute in Darjeeling for training. Then 9 were sent on an expedition to the Indochina border. Then only 2, Malath Porna and Sendha Nepali and Nad Kumar, were picked to go on the Everest expedition because they showed the greatest strength and robustness and were healthy enough to go. When she was asked why she wanted to do the hike, she said, "The aim of my expedition was to inspire young people and students from my kind of background." She also said, "For a tribal girl like me, opportunities are very rare, and I was looking for one opportunity where I could prove my caliber." She is not the youngest person to ever climb Everest. That title still belongs to Jordan Romero, who was 13 years old and 10 months, and Malavath was just short a few months from gaining the title. Nevertheless, it is still a very inspiring story. Being the youngest girl to climb Everest, she does bring a lot of publicity to her region of India, and the climb coordinator, Mohammed Ansari, said her community will gain recognition if she did, and I think that that has definitely happened. India's President Narendra Modi tweeted, "Was very happy to read about this. Congrats to our youngsters. They make us truly proud." With this recent happy event, I've been thinking about other initiatives kind of locally that have been similar to this event. And the UBC actually reported that UBC students climbed Everest in May. They just finished their trek on the 21st of May to raise money for kids in Tanzania with congenital heart defects. So their trek stemmed from the Tanzania Heart Babies Project, which was brought to UBC by Malaika Kupar, and her great uncle founded the project in 1979. It was a great cause. A group of students decided to climb Everest and raise money and awareness for her community. So I think in Canada right now, we have great health benefits, and I think it's a great cause that UBC students decided to go and hike and kind of raise awareness that some other countries don't have the health benefits that we do here, and they decided to do something about it. So you can donate to their organization to help raise money for kids in Tanzania with congenital heart defects at tzfortheheart.org. I thought the story of Malaf Porna was very inspirational. I am really happy that a young girl like that can go out there and do something that requires such strength, and I think it just proves, especially in her circumstance where she's not given a lot of opportunities like this due to her family's earnings and only make a limited amount of money, I think it's great that she had this opportunity to prove. I know she said that she wanted to prove that she could do something and prove her caliber, and I think she definitely did. I'm glad that this story was in the news. That's all for now. Thank you and have a great day.
So we're just going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Hi there, my name is Brandon.
And my name is Morme.
Do you need help finding yourself?
Do you have questions you're too afraid to ask?
Worry no more, we got your back.
Because we are two university students who have all the answers.
Just kidding.
We'd like to think that.
But what you can do is tune into All Ears at 101.9 FM every second Wednesday at 6 p.m.
to get the best advice that we can offer.
So shoot us an anonymous question
at ask.fm/allearsubc and we'll answer it live on air.
And Honeychild will be all ears.
Up next on the program, we have a resonating reconciliation documentary produced by C.J. Rice and Ian Caplett of CKGI, courtesy of the NCRA Program Exchange.
I'm the station manager at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, at UBC. I've been the station manager for over 6 years, and I've been on the NCRA board for about 5, and chair of the NCRA board for the last 2 years.
Okay, awesome.
Actually, I should change that to president, because that's the official title, but I always avoid it.
Okay. You want to do it again?
Sure. Okay. I've been on the NCRA board for the last 5 years, and I've been the president of the board for the last 2. I think it's really important for campus and community radio to have a unified voice. And when we're dealing with regulators and people who draft policy and people who give out government money. Okay, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Okay. What do you think the value and importance of the N-Theory is?
I think the N-Theory provides a really, really important bond between stations across Canada. When I started as a station manager, it was an amazing experience to go to the conference and meet my peers and learn about what they were all doing, to feel the sense of us all working together towards common goals was amazing, supporting underrepresented voices, providing independent programming, challenging mainstream media, providing different languages and content and music genres that nobody else is, supporting local musicians in a way that no other media outlets do. All those things are super, super, super important, and it's really important that the NCRA provides a unified voice for that to the general public and lobbying different levels of government. The NCRA also provides amazing networking opportunities and knowledge sharing and resources. The Disabilities Handbook our station refers to all the time, and the Compliance Handbook we use all the time, and these are resources that help share knowledge for all of our staff.
Awesome. So why do you think that people should support the activities of the NCRA through the Friends of Community Radio program?
I think having this unified voice and having the resources to actually provide more support to stations and do more lobbying is really, really important. Station staff don't have the ability or the time to do that. We're wrapped up in administering our own stations and making sure that our volunteers are supported and our programming is excellent. And we really need the NCRA to be that unifying voice that collects perspectives from across the country and represents us to different bodies of government, to the CRTC, to the Copyright Board, and provides resources and handbooks that benefit the entire sector.
Awesome. So we've talked a bit about how the NCRA impacts the sector as a whole and the importance for campus community radio stations as a collective. Can you think of some time or some personal significance that the NCRA has had for you, or some moment when the NCRA has come invaluable to you as individually?
As a station manager of CITR, how the NCRA has impacted my daily work has been incredible and invaluable. When I write a license application, the amount of feedback and assistance I get is amazing and worth so much to me and to my station. When we deal with copyright issues,
warning,
when we're trying to
this
figure out the legality
of how
things work,
in
if
the
we're thinking about how
CITR... If you are emotionally triggered or you need someone to talk to, please call toll-free the Indian Residential Schools Crisis Line at 1-866-925-4419 to access help at any time. This service is for anyone who needs it and is provided by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. This show is dedicated to the over 150,000 residential school survivors and their descendants. What you are about to hear is extremely graphic and explicit in nature, and some adults may be offended by the mature content. This is one story of survival through the horrors of residential school and the effects of attempted genocide that was inflicted on Indigenous peoples by the Canadian government in collusion with Christian churches. The residential school system was in operation for over 150 years and was one part of a concerted campaign of genocide against Indigenous peoples in Canada. It was intended to annihilate their culture of the children who attended by stripping them of their language, their family, their connection to their lands, and to indoctrinate them into the Canadian body politic. The last residential school closed in 1996 in Saskatchewan, and in 2008, Prime Minister Stephen Harper issued a formal apology to the survivors and their families. However, the policies and attitudes towards Indigenous peoples have remained directed towards assimilation, extermination of rights, and oppression of their cultures and nations. This show was produced by Ian Caplet and C.J. Rice, and we would like to extend immense gratitude and respect to Snonamo Elder and residential school survivor Geraldine Manson, as she was interviewed at her home on the lands of her ancestors upon which the city of Nanaimo was built. This audio file was recorded for the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the National Campus and Community Radio Association via CKGI 98.7 FM of Gabriola Island.
Geraldine Manson, you're an elder with Nanaimo. You've been on council, you've worked with EIU and still continue to do that. You work with archaeologists, politicians, you do important work culturally for your people. I guess I'd like to ask at this point, where you went to residential school and you went?
Yes, where I can begin and what I know now, when I turned at the age of six, I was told they came and took me to Port Alberni Residential School, where I stayed for 2 years. That was a blank. My other friends that knew me there, when I came to, I found myself to be at Alert Bay. From that time, all those years were blank. I had no memory. I had no memory of being there. I had no memory of all those other years. The only memory I have is when I was 11. Found myself at Alert Bay. I called myself the Wild Stallion. Mean, like a turtle also. Was drawn, very angry. When I arrived there with my other two sisters, we were thinking I was going to be with them, only to find we were torn apart. I was the oldest and put me into the older dorm, all lined up with some other girls. I had long hair and they cut my hair short. Some of the other girls were crying already and seeing their hair cut off in front of me. And they had this lye soap, some so-called lye. Girl was crying and the dormitory lady was just getting mad at her, combing her hair. And all I know is they had bugs, this big bug. I never seen a bug before, never knew what it was. And the lady said, this is what you get for not keeping clean. And I was just shocked because I didn't see this big bug. And I thought I had bugs too. And I didn't have a bug, but I thought, she said, this is from not being kept clean. I said, oh my. Our hair was cut short. And then we had to undress. And they scrubbed us from head to toe. And we all lined up. We had to have our same clothes, same uniform, same everything. And by that time, we didn't get to eat because we arrived late. And we all had to get this nightgown on. And the girl is whispering, wet your bed. What? Wet your bed. They won't touch you. What? Wet the bed. I didn't know what she was talking about. But I left panties on. And the night lady came by inspecting us on, and she seen I had my panties on. Take them off. And she was really mean. I thought she was mean. Take everything off. You just leave your nightgown on. And we had to strip down everything and leave the nightgown on. And the girl tapped because our beds were really close. And she said, be touching what your bed. He won't hurt you. And I didn't know what she meant. And my heart was just a pounding. Oh, my heart was pounding so bad. And then by the time the lights all went out, and it must not seem long after the door opened, and I could hear someone walking. And then I heard a girl whimpering. Oh no. And the girl said beside me, what's your bed? I was so afraid. I wet my bed. And that's all. But nothing happened to me that night. And I think it was a week and two thing, and all of a sudden, and all just in the night, my blanket taken off, and I felt the hand. Oh my God. I never knew that I was abused, sexually going to be touched. And the hand went over my mouth, and I can smell his breath and everything. And all he said, get up. And I had to get up. And he brought me into the bathroom. And from there, everything went blank. I had to lay on the floor. And I had not to make a noise. And everything there, the thing that happened, I think everything came back. He smelled. And then the thing that happened that evening is instilled in my mind. Everything was the first night I will never forget. At the age 11. And then I went back to bed. The nurse that came into the room, because when I had to make the bed, the lady that comes and checks our bed, my bed was full of blood. She said, "What happened?" And I just stood there shaking. And she asked me if I had my periods. And I looked at her. I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." She said, "Do you have your monthlies, your menstrual?" I said, "I don't know what that is." And she said, "Now go see the nurse." So I went downstairs and they checked me over. And they just looked at the nurse and looked at each other. And they knew what happened to me. And they just told me to go into the shower and get my shower. And that was it. They checked me over and didn't do anything. And that was my first ordeal. The same night, person came by. The following night, it wasn't me he went after. He went after the other girl that he took before, and she started crying. So the next time, there was another time he touched me again. But this time I went in my bed again, so no, he didn't touch me. But the more times you wet your bed, you have to go downstairs and wash your own. And then we have to have a rubber sheet. So they said, the girls start laughing. Oh, we forgot the name that we got for wetting the bed. Now we have nicknames, wetting the bed. Well, yeah, they'd rather get a nickname, won't be abused. But then the guy got smart. Rather than getting us during the night, he got us during the day. We'd have to get downstairs. We'd get punished. And we have to start scrubbing the stairs from top to bottom with a toothbrush. We got punished, and he knew when we got punished. By the time we got to the basement, he would be waiting down there. And at this one time that we were waiting, there were two of us. He got us in the there's this closet in the basement that he pushed us in the closet. Got her out of the way, and then he pushed me in the closet. This other young girl was smaller than me, so he hooked her onto the hook. On the thing, it was a hook there, and he put her up on the hook there because she was tinier than me. He didn't do what he did to me. He pulled down his pants and he made her give low job, and that's what she had to do. But after he got finished with her, and then for me, he had me lay down on the floor and on my hands and knees, and he did not do the front part. He went to the back part and had me do the back part. And then after that, and while he was doing that, she had to sit there and watch. And this poor young girl, she was younger than I was. She couldn't scream and she couldn't do anything. But she had to sit there and watch and be on a lookout for if anybody was coming. And neither one of us could scream. Because if I made any noise, she would be hit more hurt. And if she made any noise, I would get more hurt. So then another time, it was the worst time. It was my birthday. And I turned 12. And no way I would going to let anybody hurt me that the eve of my birthday, so I went to bed so bad. And they came in and I got punished for wetting the bed again. And they lectured me, 12 years old and you're still wetting the bed. You know, they took my bed off any other girl that wet the bed in the dorm. I had to go get their sheets. And wash, take all the wet girls that wet the bed, took every one of their sheets and bring it downstairs know to rub them by hand. Because I turned 12 and that was my punishment. They called me the bad weather. And there was not going to be any celebration for me on my 12th birthday. But all the other girls knew why. So, when after breakfast and we all got to go out and play, we all sat on the ground and they all sang happy birthday to me and all gave me a hug and thanked me for not saying anything. And they all understood why I went to bed and why they went to bed. And all those other night supervisors, they knew why we were doing that. And not one of them would own up to it. And the night supervisor that was abusing us, they knew why we were wetting the bed. That was a lot that was happening at Alert Bay. Those of us who weren't allowed to go home on Christmas or on holidays were stuck there. So the night supervisor got smart, but he didn't know that my brother was there. And he kind of blurted it out, you know, shared that my brother was there. And I said, what? My brother's here? And he thought I knew him. I didn't know he was there, but he mentioned that my brother Wayne was there, and he too was being harmed. We cried. He used my sister Florence, my baby sister, as one of the things dangling in front of me. If you don't do what I tell you to do, I'll go and look for your younger sister, and she'll do your dirty work for you. And I would always have to, no, don't harm my sister. And here, my sister Florence, after we got out, and I found out that he was harming her after all this time. And I didn't know that. That was what my memories of Alert Bay. When we went for our treatment after we got out of Alert Bay and we started getting our counseling, I asked why, where's my missing years? I want to know where my missing years is. Why can't I find my missing years? You know, I still don't know anything about poor little Bernie and why don't I have any of those missing years. That my doctor figures there's something really traumatizing must have happened to me when I was in poor little Bernie. Why I don't have any of those years. Why it's all blank. And where was I? Because no one knows. My sisters don't even know where I was from. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 5 years is missing. I don't know where I was. And my oldest sister is gone, so I can't ask her. And my other sisters have not seen me until I showed up in Alert Bay. So no one knows where I've been. When we got out of Alert Bay, we were only home for a weekend, and they put us into foster homes right away. And from there, I went to, from Alert Bay, came to Nanaimo, and my sisters went to Qualicum Parks before the homes, and they put me all the way over to Chilliwack. I was the only one they put over there, and I always think because I was the wild stallion, you know, I was always the one that was stubborn and wouldn't listen, and because when we were on the government car, I was the only one trying to run away. Got out of the car and started running. Put me on a ferry and sent me over there. But when they put me over there, I got my little legs and ran. From Chilliwack, they put me to Abbotsford, and again, I got stubborn and kept fighting them, and they, okay, we'll put you back to Nanaimo then. From Nanaimo, foster home, I've been in probably one from Nanoose to Hammond Bay twice, two foster homes in Hammond Bay, and two in Nanaimo. So finally I ran away and found my husband. My mother-in-law said, I'll look after her. And she did. She kept me.
And how long have you been with your husband?
47 years now. And my husband said then, I guess a man knows when someone's a virgin, because my husband said, he knew then that I wasn't a virgin. Could tell then I was abused. But I don't know how men tell, but I was abused.
So those 5 years?
They're still missing. When you lose your memory?
Yeah.
Don't know where I was.
Yeah.
Like I woke up and I was in Alert Bay. Because my mom not allowed to tell me where I was.
Did you ever get a chance to see your parents again after?
I seen my dad when my dad came to see us when I was living with my mother-in-law. But only because my dad died in 73. Our daughter was born in 69, and my mom died in 69, and my dad died 4 years later.
But they wouldn't let you go back to your parents afterwards?
No. My mom lived in Vancouver. My dad was an alcoholic.
And can I just ask a question here? So, all that not knowing, how did that affect your life going forward? And how did all of that abuse affect your life? And you've gotten out of that now. Obviously.
When my husband and I got together, young. When I kept running away from my foster homes were dictating, you do this, and you do it this way. They were very religious. They were Quinitum homes. And I couldn't do, it's like being put in a closet and had no love. Just like the residential school had no love, had no bonding, had nothing. And I was a prisoner. I was being smothered with dictating. So I kept running away. When I found my husband, not knowing he was going to be my husband, met his mother-in-law, I guess it was my first family environment that I was just like a sponge. I just couldn't get enough of their family environment. And I wanted to be there. So the foster home I was in Nanaimo here, I used to always run back. And my husband, my boyfriend then, we fell in love like at a first glance. I was only 13 when I met him. My cousin Gloria Good was his girlfriend then. We had our first child when we were only 15. We got together. Derek was born when I just turned 16, 10 days later. Daughter was born when I was 17. And then Darren, we kind of waited 2 years. He was born in 72. And my mother-in-law, she just kind of embraced me. Like, I called her mother. She